For those of you who do catch up online with this class, and if you access it through Torah Media Atlanta, you should be aware that Yisrael Killian, who runs Torah Media Atlanta, reached out because donations to that site are down. Those of you who do take advantage of it, I would suggest making a donation online when you do use it so that he can continue that site. It is March the 12th. And we are in Shmuel and Perek Chafei, chapter 25. We really got up to Lamed Tes 39. We're going to go back a couple of psukim, a couple of verses. Go back to Abigail telling her husband, Naval, about the... I'm sorry.
About this smell. She said it, not me.
I didn't know.
Telling her husband, Naval, about the what happened with David. David was coming to kill him, and that she gave him this huge gift in order to prevent him from doing so. And then it says in Pasuk Lamed Zayin, in verse 37, she waited till he was sober in the morning. Vahiva Boker, it was the morning. When the wine left Novel, Vataged Lo Ishto Esadavon Moela, his wife told him these things. His heart died inside of him, which is figurative. He was as if he was stone. Rashi explains because he was upset over the gift that was given to David. It was like 10 days. And Hashem struck Naval and he died. So we were going to talk about these 10 days. I want to read to the end of the parak, and then we'll discuss these 10 days. Vayishma David kimeis Naval. David heard that Naval died. Vayomer, and he said, Baruch Hashem asher ravitz riv cherpasi. Blessed is Hashem that he fought the battle of my shame, because remember Naval had degraded David. Miyad Naval from Naval. Ves avdo chasach me ra'ah, and his servant, meaning Hashem's servant, me, he held back from evil because he kept me from killing Naval through Abigail stopping me. Ve'isra'as Naval, and the evil of Naval, Heshiv Hashem Barosha, Hashem returned on his own head. Vayishlach David, and David sent. Vayidaber ba'Avigail, and he spoke about Abigail. In other words, he inquired about Abigail. Lekach dolo li'isha, to take her to him as a wife. As we mentioned at the outset of this parak a couple of sessions ago, that Naval was of royal blood, which we'll talk about also in a moment, and Abigail was fit to be married, if not to the king himself, but at least to a very central figure in royalty. And when Naval failed in his purpose of being that significant support to David, he would have been a person who would have not been the king himself, but he would have been a significant member of David's cabinet, so to speak. And Abigail would have been the perfect wife for that type of person. And when he failed, David now takes over that role that Naval would have played. So now David is taking over the role not only as king, but also of whatever supporting role Naval would have played. And he marries Abigail, or inquires about Abigail, that she would therefore be his wife to support him in that role. Vayavo avde David Abigail ha-Karmela, the servants of David came to Abigail to the Carmel. Vayedabru eleha lemer, they spoke to her, saying, David shlochanu elayich, David sent us to you, lekachtech lo leisha, to take you to him as a wife. Vatakam, she got up, vatishtach v'apayim marta, she bowed to the ground. Vatoman, she said, hinei amascha l'shivcha, behold, your, these are two different words for maidservants. Your maidservant is a maidservant. Lirchotz raglei avdei adoni, to wash the feet of the slaves of my master. Meaning that she completely accepted the role as being a supportive role to David. Vatimaher, and she was quick. Vatakam Avigail, and Abigail got up. Vatirkava lachamar, she rode on the donkey. Vechamesh na'arosel ha'hochos l'raglav, and her five maidens that went by her feet. David, she went after the messengers of David. She was to him as a wife. Abigail is considered to be, as we mentioned before, the one of the Nevi'os, one of the prophetesses that are mentioned in Tanakh, and she is spoken of very, very highly. It doesn't seem like there's much negative, if any, spoken about Abigail in all of the sources. She will have a son with David named Kilav. I'm almost certain that she is his mother. To double check that. Kilav, David's son, is one of the four people in the history of the world who never did an Avera his entire life. Who died be'ito shel nachash, who died only because of the snake, only because of what the snake did. So Abigail is that wife of David. That Achinoam lakach David miYisrael. Achinoam David took from Yisrael, also has a wife. We get no information about her. Fatiana gam shtehem lo menashim, and both of them were to him as wives. Now, if you're counting, this means that David now has how many wives?
Four.
Three.
Three.
He has three. He has these two now, Abigail and...
What happened to Michal?
That's the third.
Michal is the third.
That's the third. He has Abigail and Achinoam.
Abigail?
Achinoam, Abigail, and
Michal.
Those are the three.
So far.
Those are the three. But of course, he's not with Michal, because Michal is Shaul's daughter, so he is separated from her. Not willingly, but they had to be separated because Michal is still there. But then... Vishol Nasan es Michal Bito Eshes David. Shol gave Michal his daughter, the wife of David, the Palti ben Laish Asher mi Galim, to Palti ben Laish, who is from Galim. Now, this pasuk we need to speak about as well. We need there are several things that have to be discussed over here. We have to understand how Shol could do this. Shol, after all, even though he's chasing David to kill him, Shaul is still a God-fearing Jew, and to take a married woman and give her to somebody else, there's got to be some rationale for that. All the Mefarshim and the Gemara discuss this. We'll have to talk about that. Who is this man, Palti ben Laish? We'll have to talk about that. We have to discuss who is this woman, Achinoam. We got a lot of print about Abigail, but Achinoam we get nothing about. And then also it appears that this pasuk, this verse, that Shaul gave Michal, his daughter, the wife of David, to Palti ben Laish, is a result of what came before. This is not just standing here in a vacuum. It seems that this is a result of what is going on. So we need to follow with that as well. And what we probably will not get to tonight is the next perek, the next chapter, is going to be back to Shaul chasing David. After we've already had Shaul agreeing that David is going to be king and having admitted that, but we're going to be back to Shaul chasing David. We have to discuss why that happens again. Now, let's discuss first these 10 days, and let's discuss the lineage of Nabal. We've mentioned this before, but we're going to do it again. So we know that. If you have a thing, it'll be easier this way. Thank you. We know that, first of all, the Gemara says these 10 days are the Aseret Yemei Teshuvah. Thank you. These are the days from Rosh Hashanah till Yom Kippur. That Nabal, he heard about the bad news on Rosh Hashanah. That's when his heart turned to stone. And 10 days later on Yom Kippur, that is when Hashem struck him down and he died. The Medrash also says that why 10 days besides this reason? Because Hashem did not want to... Shmuel had just died, and Hashem did not want the death of Nabal to coincide with the Shiva of Shmuel. So that's 7 days till the Shiva of Shmuel will be over. And then Hashem... And then 3 days later is when Hashem killed him. Because the Gemara says that death by plague is a 3-day sickness and then death, and so that's the other reason why it's a 10-day thing. Now, we mentioned before that David HaMelech comes from Yehuda, of course, and Yehuda has two sons from Tamar, and their names are Peretz and Zerach. So we David comes from Peretz. At the end of Megillas Rus, there is the lineage of David, 10 generations from Peretz to David. Evela Tolos Peretz, 10 generations from Peretz down to David. Peretz has three sons.
So I'm going to start with parents. I'll do it in English. Parents has three sons. He has three sons.
First one's name is?
Anybody know?
We talked about it before. It's Yerachmeel.
Yerach. I'll try our best here. Me'el. Yerachmeel.
Peretz's second son's name?
Jesse.
What?
Who's Jesse?
It's really short. It's
no, you're sure it's got to be nine more generations.
Is Rum. Rum. Yerachmeel and Rum. Rum, I don't know. And his third son's name?
Sheep, I'm looking
up. What's that?
Second sheep, I'm trying to find.
His third son's name is?
Nothing, he told it.
Yeah.
Kalev. There's those three sons. His son is called Kalevi, but he's Kalev. Yerachmeel, Rum, and Kalev. Those are the three sons of Terek. Now, David comes from the middle son, from Rum. Peretz has Rum. Rum has Aminadav. Aminadav has Nachshon. Nachshon ben Aminadav. Nachshon has Salma. It goes down the line. So if we skip many generations, we end up with David. Okay. Kalev. Now Kalev, we know, was a great tzaddik. We don't know much about Yerachmeel and about Rum, but Kalev we certainly know about. Kalev was the hero of the story with the spies, and then he's the hero again with the spies that Yehoshua sent. In the time of Yehoshua into Yericho, Kalev is one of the spies that he sends. So Kalev is a seasoned spy, and he's one of the two men between 20 and 60 that live through the episode of the spies and go into Eretz Yisrael. Only Kalev and Yehoshua, they're the only two. So Kalev is very, very highly spoken about. Who is his wife?
Is it Miriam?
It's Miriam. Miriam is Kalev's wife.
Isn't there a question about that?
I noticed here in Chronicles.
No, he has two wives.
It mentions that he took Ephrath.
Yes, Ephrath is
that another name for Miriam?
Ephrath is another name for Miriam. That's right. So he has Miriam. And Kalev, we'll put here Miriam, which is not really relevant for this discussion, but it's good to know. Kalev has a son with Miriam, and his name is? Famous person?
Chur.
Chur is a very famous person and a big tzaddik. Chur has a son named? Not yet. He has a son named Uri. And he has a son named Bezalel. Okay, so this is not even in terms of generations, but so Kalev is a very, very important person. So we know that. But Kalev also has a descendant, and I don't know if it's in this line or not, but Kalev also has a descendant. I'm going to erase this so that we don't get confused. I just don't know what line it's in, but it does come from Kalev. But Kalev does have another son, not a son that he has a descendant, in the same generation as David, whose name is?
That's Nabal.
That's Nabal. Who is married to Abigail, who now gets killed by Hashem, and then David marries Abigail. Yerachmeel, all the way down the line, well past the generation of David, so it's further than these two, has a great-great-great-great-grandson, whose name is Yishmael. Yishmael is infamous for being the murderer of Gedaliah ben Achikam. That we fast Tzom Gedaliah for being the murderer of Gedaliah. The story of Tzom Gedaliah, I've mentioned to you before, is that Gedaliah was appointed by Nebuchadnezzar and the destruction of the first Beis HaMikdash, that Gedaliah was they appoint somebody to run the government.
The governor.
Okay. He was appointed governor of the remnant of the Jews in Israel after the destruction of the first Beis HaMikdash. When the Beis HaMikdash was destroyed, most Jews were dragged in chains to Babel, but some Jews remained behind, and Nebuchadnezzar allowed them to stay behind and appointed Gedaliah as the governor. He had to answer to Nebuchadnezzar, and he was governing that area. Yishmael ben Nesanya, that's this man, Yishmael. The Torah says, the Navi says, he's Mizera Hamalucha. He was a descendant of royalty, because he comes ultimately from Peretz. And Yishmael ben Nesanya, he held that he should be in charge. And therefore he plotted to and ultimately murdered Gedaliah. When he murdered Gedaliah, the remnant of the Jewish people now got scared that Nebuchadnezzar would come back and would punish them for his appointee being murdered, and therefore they wanted to run away to Egypt. Yirmiyahu, who was the prophet of the time, told them, don't run away, stay here and you'll be okay, but if you run away you'll be destroyed. And they said to him, no, you don't know what you're talking about, we need to run away. They ran away, and eventually Nebuchadnezzar conquered Egypt and killed out the remnants of the Jewish people that had run to Egypt. And that was the end of the Yishuv, of the dwelling, the Jewish dwelling in Eretz Israel. That's why Tzom Gedalia, that's why we fast. Because Asara B'Teves, the 10th of Teves, is when the city was besieged. Shiva Asar B'Tammuz, the 17th of Tammuz, is when they broke through the wall of Yerushalayim. The Tisha B'Av is when they destroyed the Beis HaMikdash. But there still was a remnant. That remnant was destroyed with the murder of Gedaliah. Yes?
Why did Yishmael do this? What did he think he would benefit?
He thought he'd become the new governor.
Okay.
So that's why we fast on Gedaliah. Now, what is striking is that, so you have the three lines. You have, obviously, the line of David, which becomes Malchus based David, the royalty of David, and it becomes his line, which ultimately leads to Mashiach. So, in terms of Peretz's descendants, I guess you would call it the most significant line is the line that runs through Ram, down to David, down to Mashiach. That's the most significant line in all of Yiddishkeit, in fact, in the whole world. That's the most significant line that there is. There is another very great line in the line of Kalev. Kalev himself being his standout. We know, of course, his son Chor, his great-grandson Bezalel, great people, huge people, wonderful, wonderful people. But unfortunately, he does have a descendant named Nabal who allows his lineage to get away with him, who believes that he should be king. And because of that, he dismisses David and ends up doing what he does, and he ends up being killed for it by Hashem in his rebellion against David. He could have been a very significant player in David's royalty, in David's kingdom. Nabal being not necessarily a second in command, but being someone who would be a very, very important person in the kingdom. And in the end, his own lineage that he believes that he deserves more gets away with him, and he is killed. We then have Yishmael, the other line of Peretz, where here you have a person who also believed that he should be the leader, and his mistake, not only does it destroy him, but it's worse than Nabal's mistake. Because Nabal, it's localized to Nabal, and Nabal had a great wife named Abigail, who turned things around and managed to limit the damage so that only Nabal was killed, and Abigail, in fact, then joins David's family. So in a certain sense, we keep that influence. But Yishmael's sin was so bad, it not only destroyed him, it destroyed the remnant of the Jewish people, and we have a fast day from now until Mashiach comes, from the time it happens until Mashiach comes, because of him. Again, the same problem, though, that he allowed his lineage to get in the way. He believed that I'm the one who should be the governor because I come from royalty. Gedaliah does not. And therefore, I deserve to be in charge. So here we have David, who is an extremely humble person, and because of that, he becomes king. We have Cohen's line with Nabal, who unfortunately allows his position to get away with him, and you have Yishmael, who does it even worse. We have other cases like this, where a person's lineage allows him to make a mistake. One, the perhaps the most important one for Sefer Shmuel is Shmuel's ancestor. Who's Shmuel's ancestor? You may remember from the beginning of Shmuel. Shmuel's ancestor is Korach. And Rashi says in Parashas Korach, one of the reasons why Korach did what he did is because he saw with Ruach HaKodesh, he saw a prophecy that he would have a descendant like Shmuel. And he said, well, if that's the case, then I must be more important than Moshe or Aaron. I should be in charge. But it wasn't so. Just because he was going to have a great descendant, Shmuel, who would be in charge and who would crown the kings, but Korach himself was not supposed to be in that position. So when a person knows his lineage, either before him or his descendants after him, it's very easy for it to get to a person's head and to make them think that they deserve certain positions, certain power. And that can lead to problems. With David, Baruch Hashem, it did not. With Nabal, it was limited to him. And with Yishmael, we have a fast day because of it. The fascinating thing is that we just learned that when is Nabal killed? When does this episode happen between David and Nabal?
Shmuel died.
It's true. Which time of the year?
She's hearing.
Between Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur. The Aseret Yom Teshuvah. That's when it happens. On Rosh Hashanah is when the incident happens with Nabal. It's on Rosh Hashanah. That's the whole incident with Abigail and David and Nabal. The whole thing is right around, it's right either right before Rosh Hashanah, it's right around Rosh Hashanah time that it all happens. And then Nabal is killed on Yom Kippur. When does Yishmael murder Gedaliah?
Oh, also Rosh Hashanah.
When do we fast?
Yeah,
right, we fast the day after Rosh Hashanah, or if the day after Rosh Hashanah is Shabbos, we fast 2 days after Rosh Hashanah on Sunday. And that's because the murder of Gedaliah, according to most commentaries, happened on Rosh Hashanah. We're not going to fast on Rosh Hashanah for it, so we fast the first day after Rosh Hashanah that we can, on Tzom Gedaliah. So the mistake that Nabal makes and the mistake that Yishmael makes happen on Rosh Hashanah. That they allow their sense of importance to get away with them. On the day where we crown Hashem as king, as Melech, they believe that their connection to Malchus, to royalty, entitles them to things, to positions. And that gets away with them. It's not a coincidence. The time of Rosh Hashanah is the day of Malchus. It's the day of royalty. It's the day that we crown Hashem as king. What about our own king? What about the king, the flesh and blood king that we have? The flesh and blood king is meant to be the person who represents Hashem's kingdom in this world. David HaMelech represents Hashem's kingdom in this world and is meant to lead us in subjugating ourselves to the royalty of Hashem. But in subjugating ourselves to David or his line, we then are able to take the next step and subjugate ourselves completely to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. David is the flesh and blood representation of Hashem's kingdom. On Rosh Hashanah, that's when Nabal says, I'm the flesh and blood representation of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Yishmael says, I'm the flesh and blood representation of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. That's the day that they focus on their claim to this entitlement. And that's the day that they are destroyed because they act upon something that they should never do. Yeah.
Do we know with Potiphar's wife and with Korach when they thought that royalty was going to come from them or that they should be?
I don't know about Korach. It says that Yosef got out of jail on Rosh Hashanah. Yeah. But it doesn't mean, well, if it was an exact thing, meaning if it was in jail exactly for a year, then it would be Rosh Hashanah. Could be. It's interesting. Interesting thing to think about. I don't know.
That's the only example I could think of. The
Egyptians had a holiday that day when she went after Yosef. She had been after him for a long time, but it came to that point where Yosef had to run away.
That point, right?
Yeah, right. Yeah.
I think it's interesting that even David was not immune from the effects Malchus around Rosh Hashanah because he was so upset with Nabal that he was willing to kill him.
Good.
I mean, it did affect him to that degree.
That's right.
Abigail
had to stop him. Right, that's very good. So that David himself, because of the rebellion of Nabal, mm-hmm. felt it was appropriate to kill him. Mm-hmm. And right, and that's also a Rosh Hashanah, right, it's right on Rosh Hashanah.
more observation. I think maybe a minor reason why it's important that the 10 days went by between Abigail telling Nabal this news and his actual death is that it really emphasizes that it was a death from Hashem, and it was not connected. By that time, we're talking about a week and a half, you know, by that time the event with David and Abigail's talking to him and everything had become remote. So it really puts it in time at a place when it's clear that Hashem is killing him.
Okay. And also, you see, Hashem gave him time. I mean, he could have done tshuva. That's the time for tshuva. He could have done tshuva. He didn't. And he was killed. Any question?
You can't do tshuva when you're in a coma.
He wasn't in a coma. It doesn't mean that he was in a coma. It just means that he was very numbed. But he was walking around. He wasn't in a coma.
Okay.
Now, the David then marries Abigail. Then he marries Ahinoam from Yisrael. Now, we don't know much about Ahinoam from Yisrael, if we know anything at all. However, the place Yisrael will come up again in a very significant place in Sefer Melachim, in the Book of Kings. The place Yisrael is going to be featured prominently in the kingdom of Achav. Achav was a king of the northern part of Eretz Yisrael, of Malchus Yisrael, and Achav was a big Rasha. Achav is an evil man, and he's one of the people who loses his chelek in Olam Haba, loses his portion of the world to come. Achav and his wife Yizebel, also a terrible Rasha, an evil woman. Achav ends up in his reign of evil. One of the most terrible things he does is, and it ultimately leads to his destruction, is that he covets a vineyard. There's a vineyard that he wants, and this vineyard is owned by a man named Navos. And Navos lives in a place called Yisrael, and he wants this vineyard, and Navos doesn't want to give it to him. So Achav, at the advice of his wife Yizebel, conspires to have Navos accused falsely of rebelling against the king, and then he is put to death for rebelling against the king. And the significance of that is that because his death was due to rebelling against the king inherits his property. And that way Achav gets the property that he wanted. The Pasuk says later, and the Gemara expands upon it, that Hashem then in Shamayim asked who would like to go and get Achav to go to battle where he will be killed in battle as punishment. And the Ruach, the spirit of Navos, goes and gets Achav to go into battle and be killed. We will, Mirtz Hashem, learn about this when we get to Sefer Melachim. But this happens in Yisrael. Yisrael is located near Shomron, which was the seat of power of the northern kingdom. Of course, in David HaMelech's time, there is no northern kingdom. There really is no consolidated kingdom yet anyway for David, but it will happen. When David becomes king, he will become king over all of Eretz Yisrael, not just the southern part, but David will have the entire Eretz Yisrael, as will Shlomo his son. It's in the reign of Shlomo's son Rechavam, David's grandson, when the kingdom will split. And Mirtz Hashem will learn about that later as well. Ahinoam from Yisrael, the fact that she is from Yisrael, that's really just about all we know about her, would seem to indicate that she was, let's say, the cream of the crop of Yisrael. Because who is fit to marry the king? She must have been a great tzaddikess. She must have been of the greatest women from the area of Yisrael. David marrying Ahinoam seems to be an indication that David is, well, so to speak, spreading his wings. David is becoming more and more influential, and more he is consolidating the kingdom. I don't mean to say that it was a marriage a political marriage. What I mean to say is that spiritually she represents that area and she is the best of that area and he marries her. Just as marrying Abigail brought into David's circle this incredibly righteous woman and she represented a certain type of royalty, so marrying Ahinoam does it as well. This is why in the next verse, in the last verse in the perek, in the chapter, Shaul gives away Michal to somebody else. Now we have to talk about how he could have justified it legally, but Shaul is trying to stop David's expansion. As David marries these very righteous women, David is expanding in his influence, in his spiritual influence, in his power. It's becoming, he's branching out. The whole idea of a king having more than one wife, and David has, it's a difference of opinion how many he actually had. He certainly had six, and he may have had 18. But the with David's wives, the different wives that he had, a wife plays a supporting role for her husband. And a king has so many different, he wears so many different hats. He is so versatile in what he does. A king isn't limited to one way, a good king isn't limited to one form of governing and one form of leadership. He has to be a very broad leader of all kinds of people. And the different wives support him in different ways, different roles that he had. I once heard from one of the mashkichim in Lakewood that, I didn't hear from him, I heard from one of his students, that although David had great wives, Michal was a great wife, Abigail was a great tzaddikas, as was Ahinoam, he had incredibly great wives, but the successor to the throne had to come from Bathsheba. We haven't learned about Bathsheba yet. But Bathsheba is going to be the wife who is the most suited to pure royalty. As much as Abigail is suited for royalty, so as much as Ahinoam is suited for royalty, as much as Michal, who's the daughter of a king, she's suited for royalty, but Bathsheba is the most suited for David in terms of royalty. Therefore, the successor had to come from her and not from the other wives. Even though, as we just mentioned, Abigail has a son who is a great tzaddik, is an understatement, right? Who is, I guess, as great a tzaddik as you can be. But nevertheless, the successor to the throne has to come from Bathsheba. So as David is expanding, I mean not politically only, I'm talking about as spiritually as well, and as he is becoming more and more complete as a king, because these wives are completing him, they are assisting him in reaching that potential of being the king, the greatest king we ever had, greater than any other king we've had since. The only possible person who could eclipse that is Mashiach. I'm not even sure whether that's true, but certainly no, since David, before Mashiach, there is no greater king than David. Then as that's happening, the way that Shaul tries to stop that or stem that is by removing Michal from him. Now, Michal is already separated from him, but to officially give her to somebody else, that will, in Shaul's mind, will cut off or stop or slow down this process of David's expansion. But we still have to explain how could it be done that we haven't done yet. Yes?
I think on a very practical plane, aside from the spiritual influence that he's accumulating, once Shaul hears that he's got wives, comes the possibility of successors to David.
Yeah.
He's not going to be able to just kill David and that's going to be the end of it. As long as there is a possibility of another
son,
then, you know, the whole thing gets way more complicated.
Yeah. Yeah, you have to kill a lot of people now if you want to stop it. Right.
Now, Shaul only has one wife throughout.
That we know of. Right, right. I mean, and she's the one we know of is Navas Hamardus, is the mother of Yohanan. Yohanan was the heir to the throne. The clear and obvious heir. No one had any doubt about that. He was the heir to the throne. He knew it. Everybody knew it. Now, how could Shaul have justified giving away Michal? So the Gemara goes through the circumstances of Michal's marriage to David. You'll recall without going through all the details again, but you recall it had to do with the 100 foreskins of the Philistines, of the Plishtim, and the whole thing over there. So the Gemara goes through how Shaul found a technicality and invalidated the marriage based on a technicality. The Gemara goes through the Shaul's reasoning. The reasoning is founded on a certain amount of very complex depth to how a marriage works and all the various nuances in how it officially works. You know, in a Jewish marriage today, the way we do it is that the chasan and kala, they go to the chuppah, and the rabbi is running the show. And the chasan doesn't know much about how things are working. He just knows what he's supposed to say and put the ring on her finger, and that's that. So I remember when I was a chassan, I once spoke to my Rebbe about it, and I had heard that you're supposed to, in terms of there's a certain acquisition you're supposed to do, and like the various. So I went to my Rebbe and I started talking about these things, and he said, all you do is do what he tells you, and you just have in mind, I want to do this right. That's all. He said, if you think too much, you might mess it up. But don't think too much. Just. But there is a lot of complexity there that's going on. We're just not understanding all the complexity, but it's happening. And the Gemara discusses that he found a technicality in the marriage. The Gemara concludes that he was wrong, that Shaul was wrong in his analysis, but it was not completely unfounded. There was what to talk about, and there was what to debate. And his conclusion was that the marriage was invalid. Now, obviously, Shaul wanted to find out that the marriage was invalid, so that may have skewed his thinking process. It's possible. I don't want to say that. I'm Chassid Shaul. I don't want to malign Shaul. But it's possible that it was true. But the Gemara's conclusion is that Shaul's analysis was flawed, and therefore Michal was in fact married to David, and therefore it was prohibited for Palti ben Laish to marry Michal. It was wrong.
Have any choice in any of this?
No, not with her father, and not with, I mean, it just, you know, he's not only are we talking about in those days, but we're talking about he's the king. No one has any choice, you know. I mean, I guess you could have tried to run away, but whatever it is.
So whoever the king wanted to marry had to marry the king.
Yeah, I mean, it would be now
clarifying.
Palti ben Laish was himself a great sage, and was himself righteous. And he realized that this may not be kosher, but he couldn't do anything about it because the king forced him. So the Gemara says, and we'll learn about this later, when David gets back Michal, because, you know, we'll talk about it when we get to David getting back Michal, but we're going to have to end very soon. But the Gemara tells us that Yosef and his incredible test that he withstood the wife of Potiphar paled in comparison to the test that Boaz had with Rus when Rus came to him in the middle of the night, which was a much greater test because the wife of Potiphar was married. Rus was single at the time, and Boaz still didn't touch her. But the Gemara says that both of them pale in comparison to Palti, because what Palti did is, he said, I have to be here. So the Gemara says, he took a sword, and he put it in the bed, he stuck it into the bed, between him and her, and he said, if anybody crosses over this line, they should be killed with this sword. And he lived like that with her in the Gemara says the same bed, but it means they were married, I mean, from the outside where they appeared to be married for it seems like it's a couple of years. It's hard to figure out exactly how long it was, and he never touched her. And the Gemara says it was the greatest withstanding of the Yetzirah that anybody has ever done. And that was Palti ben Laish. And we're talking about one of the greatest tzaddikim who ever walked the face of the earth is Palti ben Laish, this person. We'll learn more about him when we get to that discussion when David asks for his wife back. So here you have, he was literally stuck being forced into this by the king, and this was his solution to the problem.
When we come back together, it will be self-explained.
We're going to talk about later when we get to there, because otherwise she would have been prohibited to David. If another man lives with her, so then she becomes prohibited to David.
And once you're married to someone and you divorce them, you can't have it.
But she wasn't divorced. She was a married woman.
David, when he comes back with Michal.
Michal's a married woman. She's not divorced. That's the problem over here. She's still married to him.
Well,
What about the laws of honest and not allowed to be in the same room?
Yes, yes. They had no choice with that. He was stuck. The king forced them into it.
Were there any children from Paltib and Laish that we should know about? Any descendants?
That's a good question. I don't know. I mean, obviously not from Michal, but I don't know. I don't know. It's a very good question.
For those of you who do catch up online with this class, and if you access it through Torah Media Atlanta, you should be aware that Yisrael Killian, who runs Torah Media Atlanta, reached out because donations to that site are down. Those of you who do take advantage of it, I would suggest making a donation online when you do use it so that he can continue that site.